Happy June and happy Pride, celebrating pride in all of us. All this month, Richard Skipper celebrates those that are making a difference in the LGBTQ community. Never gossipy, the antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Monday, everyone, and welcome to Richard Skipper Celebrates. Happy June, happy Pride. Today is also, thank God, it's Monday Day. I don't know who comes up with these things, but it is. But today we are celebrating one of my favorite people in the world, beyond cabaret, the world, and that's Mark Nadler. The first time that I saw Mark Nadler was at the Five Oaks in the late 80s, and he came tapping in. He was wearing these glitter tap shoes, and he tapped his way across to Marie Blake, who was at the piano, and he did an entire production number. If he had a chorus behind him, nobody would have ever noticed anyway. So that was the first time I met Mark. And the last time I saw Mark was just before the pandemic hit. Mark, I am so thrilled that you're here today, and we're going to celebrate you.
Wow. I couldn't be more excited. I just want to correct one thing, Richard. It was not the late 80s. It was the early 80s. It was like 1983, 84, something like that.
Well, I started going to the cabaret. Well, I was trying to be kind. I was
We're older than we look. Well, I'm older than you look.
No. You and I are both. I just turned 60, and on the horizon for you, because you had that incredible show, 1961, which was one of my favorite cabaret shows because it celebrated that year and the music that came out of that year. So many iconic songs. Yeah. But I want to ask you, this is June. It's Pride Month.
Busting out all over.
And what does Pride mean to you?
Well, I mean, I've always been proud to be gay. You've known me my whole life.
Yes.
And
Most of it.
Yeah, I mean, short of 19 or 23 years or something. I think we met when we were around 23 years old.
That's right.
As far as I'm concerned, that's my whole life. And I, you know, as people know, if they know me at all, I grew up in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I am Jewish and I am gay, and I always was Jewish and I always was gay. But the minority with whom I identified most was being gay. Being Jewish in Iowa was its own trauma. But everybody in my family went through that. But being gay was a very separate thing. And when we were little kids, Richard, we had Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland and these singers who expressed for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were teenagers, we got Bette Midler. And once Bette Midler hit my record player, I developed a pride in being of that camp ilk.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, really, by that time I was performing in public. I've been performing professionally for 5 or 6 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started incorporating her shtick into my shows. And I was very proud of that. And I was very proud I wasn't able in the Long Straw Saloon in Cedar Falls, Iowa, to say I was gay.
Mm-hmm.
But I refused to say I was straight. And I was working with saloon girls and I didn't let them sit on my knee.
Mm.
And I didn't play that game. I never played that game. And I was very lucky because I went to the Interlochen Arts Academy for high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there from the time I was 14 until the time I was 18. And I was out from the moment I got there, because it was an arts school. And so we could do that. It wasn't West High School, Waterloo, Iowa. And so I've always been allowed to be proud. Mm-hmm. And my parents never fought me on it. They loved me for who I was and encouraged me to love me for who I was. So that's pride is, but also being somebody who lived through the height of the AIDS epidemic and being somebody who lost a long-term partner to actually two long-term partners to AIDS and countless friends. Hmm. My pride has a kind of depth to it because there is a pride of survival. And I'm sure you have that too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's,
when I was working in the bars and you would come into Marie's Crisis and sing the most uncanny Carol Channing impersonation, I didn't know whether to shit or go blind. It was so incredible to me. And there you were in this piano bar with no mic and everybody just put their drinks down and lit. Oh, what is that? Well, it was the and, this was the mid 80s. Mm-hmm. And we were navigating all of that. I think you met Danny around that time, didn't you?
I met Danny in 1990 at Marie's Crisis because I eventually became a waiter there.
Right. Well, that was after I left Marie's Crisis. But I
don't think Marie's Crisis would have been big enough for the two of us.
<It wasn't.
laughs> I don't think so.
But we worked that. Oh, my God, did we work that place? Well, the thing about Marie's Crisis was, for me, my shift pay was $60. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to take any money at all, it was about tips.
And you worked it.
Oh, I had to. I had to pay my rent. So they talk about screaming queens. I was literally screaming. I had to keep their attention to get those tips, you know. I learned a lot working in those places.
I absolutely did. But you said something earlier that I want to go back to. And you said that, you know, when you think of your life, you know, that your life truly began when you came to New York. I came to New York in 1979. I remember getting on the plane and someone asked me what my name was. And for the first time, I uttered Richard, because I was always Ricky growing up in South Carolina. And saying that, I don't know where it came from, so I've always been Richard in New York. And I celebrate two birthdays, February 11th, my actual birthday, and August 5th, 1979 was when my life truly began for me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I want to go back, you know, to your Ohio days.
Iowa.
I want to know a little bit about the little boy, Mark Nadler, growing up in Ohio. You and I.
Iowa, not Ohio. If only it had been Ohio.
why, Ohio? No, Iowa, I meant Iowa.
That was the Iowa way to treat you when we treat you, which we may not do at all.
Exactly. But when you were growing up, you and I both grew up at the same time. Did you grow up in a TV household watching the variety shows on television?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. And those variety shows had a great effect on me. Particularly the Carol Burnett show.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much Lawrence Welk. I really avoided that as much as I possibly could. And let me see what.
Although I bet you can.
You know what? I love. I'm sorry.
I bet you could name several of the people that were on the Lawrence Welk show.
only because I'm that kind of queen, yes. But not because I watched it.
Exactly.
But. Sonny and Cher. I watched Sonny and Cher. I watched Julie Andrews for a short time had a variety show. I thought that was one of the best of all of them. It didn't last very long. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I watched those shows. I lived for those shows. I kept planning what my numbers were going to be when they finally got around to inviting me to be on. And I'm still planning.
Well, I used to imitate all the numbers that I saw. I had a little tape recorder, and I would tape what I saw on television. I would learn these routines. That's how I learned all the Carol Channing material that I...
Okay, so here's the complex thing about growing up in the 1960s, about being a child in the 1960s with liberal parents living in a conservative town. My parents had a record album set of Peter, Paul, and Mary live. So where every other gay boy was singing along and performing Judy Garland at the Palace, I was literally learning the lines and reciting along with it with Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary during their live concert, and all because they got such incredible applause and laughs. He was funny. He got good laughs.
Yes.
So yeah, I was Peter, Paul, and Mary.
But when did the spark happen for you? I mean, you're listening to the albums, you're watching TV specials. When was that? What was that defining moment for you when you said, this is the life that I'm going to lead?
I honestly don't remember. I can't tell you, because I was performing in public by the time I was less than 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I just truly don't remember a time when I wasn't. And so because I was performing, I must have wanted to. I honestly do not remember a time when I wasn't performing in front of people and getting lots of praise. You know, there's nothing cuter than a little kid who can sing and play the piano and tell jokes. Well, they're Peter Yarrow's jokes, but they didn't know that.
Well, did you perform in high school? Did you perform in the surrounding area?
High school was a performing arts high school. Mm-hmm. I performed in grade school. I performed in kindergarten. I performed in preschool at the piano. Mm-hmm. And boy, did I get beat up a lot for that. Literally. But I persevered. I knew what I wanted. And and the more I would get bullied and beaten, the more I was determined that I was going to continue doing this and I was going to make a success of it and fuck them. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of that in me, I have to admit.
Well, good for you. And did you go to college or did you come to New York?
I was done with Interlochen, and I came right to New York City and went into the business.
Yes. So why New York? I mean, there's a fork in the road for all of us. It could have been L.A., or it could have been New York, but did you always want to be on the stage?
Yeah. I mean, of course I always wanted to be a movie star. That was, you know, that's the childhood dream. Mm-hmm. But by the time I got to New York, I had a resume. I had been performing professionally. I had done summer stock. I had done plenty of theater. I mean, the Interlochen Arts Academy was a school that is a school that is about training young artists. In my class was Felicity Huffman. She went on to be a movie star. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of a place. And so I got lots of stage experience. And in my for my senior off-campus project, I got to come to New York City and apprentice with a theater company called the Writers Theater, out of Manhattan Plaza, which had just been built. And I got to know New York City actors, New York City directors. And I did my first cabaret show when Bobby Kneeland, God love him,
God bless him,
cast me in a cabaret review. It was me. Lenny Babish was the music director. Bobby directed it. Wow. Thelma Hazzouri, this incredible singer.
Yes.
Featured singer in it. And there were three other singers who I don't remember. But it was at a place called Scene One down in the Village. And there was an ad in Backstage Magazine, and I saw it. And I auditioned, and I got cast. So that was right away, because this was part of my high school education.
It was just a continuation, but I want to back up for a minute.
I just came back.
So when you came to New York, did you know anyone here? Where did you live when you first got here? Have you ever done any other survival jobs or have you always made a living in this business?
I, well, that half year when I was still in high school, I lived on 50th Street between 10th and 11th Avenues. It was really Hell's Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a very involved story about my grandmother coming to visit and running into a hooker who had no, her tits were out. And they landed like right in my grandmother's eyes. And my grandmother was this austere German woman. And I'm walking home with my grandmother and she's, this hooker's tits are in my grandmother's eyes. And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, this is, I might as well just die now. And my grandmother, who was actually a very hip woman, with the, as soon as she pulled away from the tits, she looked up at the woman and she said, very nice.
Now I see where it all comes from, Mark.
Grandma, well, I could tell a lot of stories about my grandmother. My grandmother got my family out of Nazi Germany single-handedly. She was a very tough woman. And frankly, I suspect that in her youth, she had sex with other women. It was something that German women were doing a lot of during the Weimar Republic, which is when she was in her prime. And then when I moved back to New York, I did know people because I had been here for a half a year already. So I had friends who lived here. And I, at that point, I lived, I lived in every single borough. I moved in with my dance teacher from Interlaken, a woman named Valerie Feit. And we lived in Brooklyn Heights. It wasn't really Brooklyn Heights. It was Lower Park Slope is really what it was. And very, very dangerous block. But I got mugged twice my first year here. Mm-hmm. Baptism by fire, you know. It was no worse than being Jewish in Waterloo, Iowa. And the opportunities were a lot more. But I did know people. And I did have, for a very short time, a job not in show business. I was taking acting classes at the Terry Schreiber Acting Studio. Mm-hmm. And my brother lived here for a brief time, and his best friend sold pot for a living. And so my brother's best friend, trying to help me out, said, I'm going to give you a bag of really good pot just to get on your feet, sell this, and you'll have some money to, you know, to get your headshots and whatever. Very generous. Just gave it to me. So in acting class, I got up to do my monologue, and before I started, I said, before I do this piece, I just want you all to know that I'm selling some really good pot. And if you want to buy it, see me after class. Well, after class, my teacher grabs me and she said, do you understand that what you did is illegal and could get me my studio? You can't do that. She said, I'm getting you a job. She said, you have dance training, right? I said, yes, I have dance training. She said, okay, go to the New York Health and Racket Club. Tell them I sent you. And tell them you're a dancer and tell them whatever they say, have you ever done this? Just say, yes, I have. So I did. And I got hired to be a calisthenics, yoga, and aerobics exercise teacher at the New York Health and Racket Club, which I did for about 2.5 months. And my classes were very popular because of the music that I put together for us to jump around to. And South African music of Maria Makeba and Mozart Divertimenti to do our arm exercises. It was all lots of very interesting, people loved it. So I had very popular classes. And it just so happens about 2 months into that gig was April Fool's Day. And I thought, wouldn't it be hysterical to have the whole class run through? I said, as the class is starting, I said, come on, let's start running in place. We're running in place. Okay. I said, follow me. And when we get to the manager's office, keep running in place. And on the count of three, I want you all to yell, the jogging machines are broken. And then we're going to run back into the studio. So we ran through the whole club and I'm singing. Come with me, we're going to the manager. Come with me, come on to the man. And we're all running through the crowd. And we get into the manager's, and everybody's running in place. And I said, 1, 2, 3, the jogging machines are broken. And they all run back. After that class, the manager pulled me into his office without my class. And he said, do you realize that by having those people run through the entire club, our insurance is going to skyrocket if anybody finds out you did this. Do you know how many people could have fallen and hurt themselves? He said, you are out of here. So that was my short-lived. Then I went back to playing in the piano bars. I thought, yeah, whatever.
Well, let me tell you my similar story. I was working for the Green Room Answering Service, and Robert Lapone was one of the clients. And he called one night, and he said, I need a wake-up call for 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I said, will that be in person or over the phone?
Did you know, or were you just flirting?
No, I was being Ella Peterson from Bells Are Ringing. So he said, well, in person, of course. And I said, would you like coffee? And how do you take your coffee? And would you like a bagel or a Danish with that? He told me what he wanted. And the next morning at 7 o'clock, I rang his buzzer because I had his address. And I delivered coffee and a bagel to Robert Lapone. And he called my company and he said, this is the greatest thing that you have ever done. And I thought so as well, but I was called into the manager's office. And he said, if you ever go to a client's apartment again, unless they've invited you and that's your own business, you are out of here. So I had a similar experience. But did you ever do any other odd jobs beyond that?
No, that's the only job I ever did outside of show business. I was a waiter for exactly a half a week. And that was because I had been playing. I was hired to play the lobby piano in the Fairmont Hotel of Dallas, Texas. And having to entertain Mary Kay sales ladies while they're chattering away, splitting a check, ordering one pot of coffee because you could, and asking for 3 cups and then splitting the check 3 ways. I mean, not that I was waiting on them, but I saw how they were treating the waiters. And of course they were treating me terribly. Mm-hmm. And I really don't want my life to be this. I don't want to play in hotel lobbies or piano bars or any of this. I'm through with show. I'm done. I'm going to go be a waiter and if I get an acting job, then, which is what I came to New York to do, I'm going to do it the way everybody else has done. I'm going to be a waiter. And I got myself a job as a waiter, and it lasted exactly a half a week because I was really a horrible waiter. I was the worst waiter ever. I would have killed me if I had gone to a restaurant and I was my waiter. And so then after that humiliation of being a waiter, I thought, you know what? Nothing is worse than that. I'll go back to playing piano. And I did promise myself, this was my promise, and this is what made the difference for me. I promised myself, because for me, whenever I wasn't getting an acting job or a singing, dancing job in a show, my version of waiting tables was playing in piano bars. That was my fallback. So you asked about LA. I actually got signed to a manager after I did my first Broadway show, which was a big flop that I'm very proud of. I was signed by a manager to move to LA. He said, you're a shoo-in for sitcoms. You are a shoo-in for sitcoms. Have you seen me in any? And I said to him, all right, fine. Okay. He said, you're 32 years old. Come to LA. Give me 4 years. When you're done, if it doesn't work out, you'll only be 36. There's no difference between 36 and 32. And you can go back to New York. And so I gave him 4 years. He wasn't able to make anything happen. But I must say, while I was in LA, that's when I studied acting with Charles Nelson Reilly. That's when I got my equity card at the Pasadena Playhouse. You know, a lot happened for me in LA, and it was great for me. That's when I met Gretchen Weiler and Anna White, who became two of my best friends. And I mean, really a lot. And then when I came back from LA, that's when I started working at Sardi's, and that everything changed. And so, but I did make this promise to myself when I was in LA. I said, you know what? When I turn 40 years old, I promise to me, I will never work another piano bar as long as I live once I'm 40 years old. Because if you're 40 and you're still having to do that, then guess what? You didn't make it, and too bad, and who cares? Do something else. Mm-hmm. And luckily for me, before I was 40, I started to be able to make a really good living and not have to work in piano bars.
Well, with all due respect to those that are still doing that, I want to say,
my God, I agree. It's a job,
and this is a choice that you made. But it's you, What I love about you, Mark, is that you have mapped out your own path in this business. You have created a niche. There's no one else like you, let's face it. You have, you know, people flock to see your shows when you're performing. At least that's my perception. Everyone is there to see you and support you. And you are beloved in this community. When did you start getting a name for yourself in the New York City cabaret scene?
Really, when I came back from LA, I had planted the seed. Before I left for LA, I mean, the first big cabaret show I did was when I was booked at the Ballroom. And I was still playing at the Five Oaks when I was booked at the Ballroom. And when I was at the Five Oaks, I had a friend named Leon Van Leeuwen. He was this wonderful guy, big cabaret fan. And he said, and he's the one who said to me, get a card that says, I want to be on Mark Nadler's mailing list, and put it on every table every time you perform anywhere and start creating a mailing list. Well, while I was at the Five Oaks, I put together a mailing list of, by the time I left, about 2,700 people. And that was my audience base. I still have a lot of people who come to see me from that original audience base. And then because I had a nice sized mailing list, I was able to get booked at the Ballroom. And the nice thing about the Ballroom was they put posters all over town with your name and your picture. And so my name got out there a little bit. Then in 1992, my first partner produced a show of mine at the Village Gate. And again, posters everywhere with my name. And that show was pretty successful at the Village Gate. It was called 7 o'clock at the Top of the Gate. And I had this small jazz band that I played with of all women, and was choreographed by the women danced while they played their instruments. And I, of course, danced while I played. It was a very fun show. And then after that, Tony Stevens was the choreographer. He was, Cheetah's choreographer. And that's why my partner hired him. And then after that, I was cast in this Broadway show that was a big flop, but my name was getting out there. And then I went to LA. And for the 4 years I was in LA, I kept coming back in the summers, because LA is dead in the summer. And I would work at Steve McGraw's, which is now the Triad. And I would work at Maxime's. When I started working at Maxime's, my name got out there a lot more, because Steve Dunleavy, who had this show called Current Affair on Channel 5, Fox, brought Jennifer Flowers in to hear me, because they had just finished taping a segment that day. It was all about her affair with Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And Bill Clinton was running for president at that time. And so she did this Current Affair show where she talked about, so she's sitting there with Steve Dunleavy. The show hasn't aired yet. And I saw that Jennifer Flowers was sitting there. Well, I read the newspapers. And I went over to the maitre d' at Maxime's, and I said, Claude, his name was Claude. I said, Claude, do you see who just walked in? He said, no, who is that? I said, Claude, that's Jennifer Flowers. He's French. Who is Jennifer Flowers? I said, listen to me, Claude. You get that woman as many drinks as she can handle. You tell her they're all on me. You ply that woman with liquor. I'm going to get us some publicity. Because I knew who Steve Dunleavy was. Mm-hmm. This was primetime gossip television.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
I went over to her after she had had about four or five of whatever she was drinking. And I said, Miss Flowers, we're so honored that you're here in our room. Would you? Because I had read that she had been a backup singer for Tammy Wynette. I said, would you grace us with a song? I would be so honored if you would get up and sing a song with me. Without missing a beat, she jumped right up. She said, Lady is a Tramp, in G as in Jennifer. And she, got, and she sang, Lady is a Tramp, What I Did for Love, He's Just My Bill, having had an affair with Bill Clinton. And then This is 2 weeks after Hillary Clinton said on 60 Minutes that she wasn't the kind of woman who would stand by your man.
Yes. Well,
Jennifer Close would stand by your man. Well, the place went crazy. And the next day, and that night after the show was done, Steve Dunleavy pulled me aside and he said, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, you get back in here. I'm bringing Jennifer. We're going to do this again as if just exactly how it happened tonight, but we're going to have cameras. And we did. Jennifer and I came in and she sang all of those songs again. And I played for her and I kibitzed with her. And then that was on A Current Affair the next night. And so my name got out more. You know, I was lucky that way. I was lucky that there was a producer of the Donahue Show who saw me at Broadway Baby, and she booked me on the Donahue Show. That was like in 1989. So my name was out there. So when I came back from L.A., people had missed me. Mm-hmm. And when I first played at Sardi's, I had another real stroke of luck. I had booked myself at Sardi's, and I was producing this thing myself. They never had cabaret at Sardi's. But I said, you know what? I'll rent the piano. I'll rent the lights. I'll rent the sound system. You just give me the room. Because I wanted the imprimatur of Sardi's. Well, Donald Smith of the Cabaret Convention did not like me, did not want to know from me. I was exactly the kind of performer he did not want in his shows.
Mm-hmm.
But Tom Anderson, this wonderful singer, Tom Anderson, got sick. He got sick. And Ron Cohn was working in Donald Smith's office. And Ron said, look, he said to Donald, you need somebody. Mark Nadler's fun. Give him a chance. Give him a chance. You need somebody. He's available. Ask him to do it. So I get this call from Donald Smith's office. Will I do the cabaret convention on October 14th, which happens to be my birthday?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'll be thrilled to do it. Well, I did it and I went out and I can honestly say I only did one tune. I did I Love a Piano and I stopped the show cold. And the next night when I opened at Sardi's, it was jammed with people who had been at the cabaret convention the night before. So we can say what we want about the cabaret convention, but if it weren't for that, I don't know if I would have had that jump start that made my Sardi's shows such a success. It was a combination of that, hiring Marianne LaPinto to be my publicist, and then hiring Laura Davis to be my publicist. Mm-hmm. And the combination of all of that, plus the people missing me for 4 years, it all built up and I steamrolled ever since then. And I've been able to ride that tide. That was, my God, that was 23 years ago.
Wow. But you also have the talent to go with that. I mean, there have been many people who have hit the stage at the cabaret convention, and I can name a few names, incredible artists who, for whatever reason, did not go over at the cabaret convention. That has something to do with the timing and the placement sometimes. Who you follow, who follows you.
Has to do with the material that you choose.
Yes, yes. I mean, it happened for you, and it also happened for Marilyn May. Let's face it. It turned her life around. So Eminem, right there. there it is. That's the secret. But you talked earlier about, you know, getting that publicity with A Current Affair. The business.
Yeah, the Donahue Show. Where I was on the Donahue Show with Randy Graff and Lori Beachman herself. And the Jewish comedian, Jackie Mason. And I was on there with them performing. And that was when I was doing the ballroom. And that was huge. I mean, that was watched all over the country. Enormous.
The business has changed a lot since both of us first arrived in New York. What are some of the things that you really love that have changed in the business and have helped you tremendously? What are some of the things besides the people that are no longer with us that you miss the most about those early days of coming to New York? I mean, I call them the hunger years. To me, they were still magical. I mean, running out and seeing your friends and getting up and performing, and it never felt like competition. Everybody was having a great time.
What do I miss? I do miss the Five Oaks itself. I miss the very special atmosphere that was there. Mm-hmm. That was such a unique place. And I don't think anything has come close. Mm-hmm. The fact that people went there, it was a restaurant with a piano, but people went there to hear the music, mm-hmm. party, with the music being the center of the party. And to get up and perform. I mean, you would have Richard Skipper get up and perform, and then you would have Liza Minnelli would come in and do a number, and Michael Feinstein would come in and do a number, and then you'd have Dennis the Cowboy sing "Tie Young Ram."
I mean, it was a name I have not thought about in a long time.
It was. I mean, talk about Dickensian. It was the worst of times. It was the best of times. Every single night. And there just isn't that kind of spontaneous. I mean, there are places like the Front Room at Don't Tell Mama, but it's not the same. It's not the same. The waiters were singing. The waiters, if they weren't singing, they were such personalities. Alice the waitress.
Oh, yeah. Scotland,
you know, these people had real personalities. And it was, that place is probably the thing that I think New York lacks the most. And frankly, I quit smoking 21 years ago. But when people stopped being allowed to smoke inside, and I'm all for it, I don't want any of us to get secondhand smoke and lung cancer, but there was something about that. Smoking, smoke-filled piano bars, and people singing their lungs out and making out right in front of you while you're singing a love song, and this just completely throwing caution to the wind, and that and working until 4 a.m.
mm-hmm.
and 3 a.m. Clubs stayed open. And after they were done, restaurants stayed open. What you could go at 4 a.m. and have breakfast. There are almost no places where you can do that now. Very few 24-hour diners and places. And the after-hours scene. I miss the after-hours scene. I wouldn't be up to it anymore, but...
I do. Well, you know, I absolutely remember that as well.
Yeah, dancing until noon in a dark club. Oh, my God. Those were days. Those were days.
But I want to also ask you about your collaboration with KT Sullivan, because the two of you together, you created such magic when you come together. Was it your Lerner and Lowe show?
Yeah, actually the last show we did was a show that was celebrating our 25 years of collaboration. Mm-hmm. And the show before that was Alan J. Lerner.
But what is it that this chemistry that the two of you bring together? I mean, you're so unique in your own performing styles. You're your own person. She's her own person. But you come together and it's alchemy.
Well, I think for one thing, it's like they used to say about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. They were both so different from each other that she gave him sex and he gave her class, is what they used to say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know who's giving who sex and who's giving who class between KT and me. We both have plenty of both. But I think that the fact that we're so different from each other and that we complement each other, we're also, both of us are from the Midwest. She's from Oklahoma. And both of us are small town kids who came to the big city and have become big city people. And we do both love the same songs and we love the same humor. And listen, KT saved my life. KT, I was playing piano bars in LA and couldn't get back to New York. I didn't have the money. And KT started hiring me to be her accompanist everywhere she went and paying me half of whatever it is she made so that I would be able to afford to get back to New York. At that time, my partner who I had been with at that point for 17 years was dying of AIDS. Mm. And every penny I had was about supporting us. And every spare moment I had was about being his caretaker. And he did not want to die in LA. As Truman Capote said, to die in LA is a redundancy.
Mm.
And so he wanted to die in New York, and he wanted to die in a house. He wanted to live in a house, not in an apartment, before he died. And thanks to KT hiring me as her accompanist and paying me half of whatever she made every time she had a gig, I was able to move the two of us back to New York and move us into the house that I lived in for 23 years until I moved into this one I'm in now.
Wow.
Yeah, no, KT saved my life. So then, and the other thing KT did, again, she had already been a staple at the Algonquin and for a couple of years. And Barbara McGurn, who was booking the Algonquin, Donald Smith decided after all that he liked me. After I did several cabaret conventions and I did well, and he decided that he liked me. So at that time, they were doing this thing. That's when the cabaret convention was a town hall. And they were doing this thing where certain artists would be asked to do an act at the Algonquin, one show following the cabaret convention. Mm-hmm. And he gave me the opportunity to do one of those shows. This was going to be a Wednesday night. It was going to be right after the cabaret convention. So it was a 9 o'clock show. And it sold out. As soon as that was announced, it sold out so fast that Barbara McGurn, who was booking the Algonquin, asked me if I would do an 11 o'clock show as well that same night. And I did. I said, yes, I'll do two shows in a row happily. And so she booked me for the 11 o'clock slot as well. I was doing two shows at the Algonquin. I never dreamed I would play the Algonquin. And I was dying to play the Algonquin because that's what launched Feinstein's career and Connick's career. And so I thought, this is it. I am going to do the show of shows. And I spent about 7 months creating a show. And that was my show, Tchaikovsky and Other Russians. Well, the first time I did it, I did a tryout of it, and it came in at exactly an hour and 15 minutes. But at the tryout, there was no applause. There was no laughter. When I did it at the Algonquin for the 9 o'clock slot, it was an hour and 45 minutes long. Barbara McGurn went through the roof because 9 o'clock plus an hour and 45 minutes is 10:45. Mm-hmm. So now she has people lined up out in the lobby trying to get into the 11 o'clock, and the 9 o'clock isn't even done yet, and they have to clean up and turn over the room. And these are union waiters, so this is going to cost them money. Well, Barbara McGurn said, Mark Nadler will never play the Algonquin again as long as I live. Well, KT to the rescue. She started inviting me to have drinks with Barbara. We got to know each other. Barbara and I started to enjoy each other's company. KT finally got Barbara to book KT and me as a duo at the Algonquin. And that's when we did our Julie Stein show. And that was such a success that we then got to do five other shows at the Algonquin as a duo. And those six shows at the Algonquin, really, with KT, were among the highlights of my career. I mean, because people come to see you at the Algonquin that you could never meet otherwise. Barbara Walters, Tony Bennett, the names go on and on and on. Christine Baranski. I mean, and to be out in the lobby after you've done your show and these people come up to you and shake your hand and tell you how much they love what you did. I became friends with Marion Seldes out of doing the Algonquin, and Tammy Grimes. And I mean, I'm not a name dropper, but these names really mean a lot to me. So be able to call them friends turned my world upside down. And again, KT gave me that.
And Irvin Drake, who made a huge difference in my life. I met him at your show. I don't know if you remember this. I called you and I said, I wanted to do one of the songs that he wrote for Carol Channing. And, he gave me that song.
Irvin, well, you go ahead with your story because I want to hear.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. What were you saying?
Irvin called me and he said, "Do you know this guy, Richard Skipper?" I said, "Of course I know Richard Skipper." He said, "Wait till you hear him do this song." He was blown away by your performance of that.
Well, I'll tell you the funny thing about this.
You did all the verses.
I did all. Well, he wrote new verses for me to sing, and the song went on for 20 minutes. But I called you. You gave me his number. And I called him and he said, "Who the hell are you?" And I started to tell him, he says, "Are you any good?" And I said, "Well, ask others." And he says, "I will." And he hung up. And I guess he called you. But I want to ask you, before we run out of time.
For those who don't know, because there are some people who don't know, Irvin Drake was one of our main songwriters in the first half, in the middle of the 20th century. He wrote When I Was 17, It Was a Very Good Year. He wrote, I Believe, For Every Drop of Rain That Falls, A Flower Grows. He wrote
Good Morning Heartache.
He wrote the lyrics to Tico Tico. He was a major, major songwriter, Irvin Drake. Anyway.
But I was lucky enough to see you do your solo show years ago at Flushing Town Hall. And you're coming back to Flushing. I was there with our friends Hugh and Ellen. God bless you, Hugh. We all went out to Flushing. Had the hardest time finding a restaurant.
They're the greatest Korean restaurants in the world.
I know, but everything was packed. But we went to see you, and you're coming back to Flushing Town Hall. You have a new show just in time for Pride. So I want to talk a little bit about that show.
Great, great. That show is called Gay As They Say, which is a lyric from a song that Billy Strayhorn wrote called Something to Live For. And I do that song in the show. Gay As They Say, this show is... I have noticed through the decades of performing these songs that the gay songwriters who were writing pre-Stonewall, particularly during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and particularly the closeted ones, mm-hmm. like Cole Porter, like Noel Coward, like Lorenz Hart, they put lyrics in their songs that if you know gay lingo, you cannot miss that these lyrics are references to gay life, little winks and nods. They put these lyrics into these songs for each other. They put these lyrics into their songs as a way to say fuck you to the censors because it was over their heads. Mm-hmm. And one of those censors for Larry Hart was Richard Rodgers. When Rodgers and Hart were writing their songs, Larry Hart called Richard Rodgers the principal because Richard Rodgers wouldn't let anything get passed. But gay references were just, Richard Rodgers didn't get it. And so so this show is examining those gay references in the songs and finding those. And then of course it eventually becomes about the lives that these men lived in that closeted pre-Stonewall time. And Billy Strayhorn, who was Duke Ellington's co-composer, he wrote Take the A-Train, and he wrote Satin Doll, and he wrote Lush Life, and he wrote this song, Something to Live For, and he wonderful songwriter. And his main arranger, Billy Strayhorn, was Ellington's main arranger. And Billy Strayhorn was also gay. He was black. He was very small. They called him Sweet Pea. But he lived a completely different life than those other three guys. And I get into that in the show. It's an interesting show for me to do. And it's my gift to the younger generation of the LGBTQ community, who I think need to be reminded of where we came from.
Absolutely.
And I've got in at the tail end of that, just as I was, and just as you were, coming to our teens and our late teens and into our we were coming into full bloom, the sexual revolution was in full bloom, and we got here just before anybody knew what AIDS was.
Exactly,
lit in right at that time. So I got to know that time, and I consider myself privileged to be able to be a messenger to the younger members of our community. And I want them to know where we came from.
And when will you be at Flushing Town Hall?
This Thursday. The show is at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be performing at Flushing Town Hall live on their stage, and they will be live streaming it. And people can buy tickets for only $5 a ticket to watch the live stream at flushingtownhall.org.
And if you can resend me all that information, I can make sure that that's in all the text on YouTube. And how long will it be available after the performance for people to see?
I don't know. I know that it will be available, but I don't know. I mean, the fun thing would be to watch this Thursday at 7 p.m. as if you're there. Pour yourself a drink, sing along. I don't mind if you sing along because you won't be in the same room as me. So go ahead and do it.
I also want to mention that just before COVID hit, you were directing Pamela Morgan in a show. We were supposed to do a number together. Hopefully that will happen again someday. And then you were scheduled to go to London, and that got canceled. And I remember, and I owe you an apology, because we went to see
Martha and
Leanne Borghese. And I went over to hug you, and you said, "Don't touch me. Don't touch me. Don't touch me." And I said, "Oh, Mark, get over it." Little did I know what was ahead for all of us. And you said, "Richard, I just got canceled for London." And this.
What I did say to you, just to be very clear, I did say, "I won't hug you, Richard," is what I said. I won't hug you. I said, "But I will bump your ass with mine. Let's ask her." And you said, "Oh, come on. We hug each other in show business because that's who you are."
Right.
But my thought at the time was, I'm going to London next week. I do not want to jeopardize getting on that plane. Well, then, of course, that was canceled. Mm-hmm. But I was being careful so that I, as it turned out, I contracted COVID anyway.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. When I was doing, did you know about my daily songs that I was sending out?
Yes.
I had COVID while I was doing those song a days for the first, I did a week of them. And then the second week I got really sick, but I had, the show must go on. And it was only the song a day videos took 10 minutes to make. So for 10 minutes, I would rally and get my energy together and I would go to the piano and I would do a number and then I would pass out. And I did that for a couple of weeks and then it passed. It took me a long time to get my strength back. But yeah, I had it. Despite all of that being careful, I could have given you the hug, but then you would have had it.
Then I would have had it. Well, before we run out of time, I've got some lightning round questions. These are questions that I've collected or have been sent to me. What experience has made you the wisest?
The experience that made me the wisest is probably nursing my partner to his death, which sounds like a sad thing, but to be honest with you, it was the greatest privilege that I've ever had and will ever have, as far as I know. There is no more, you cannot be more intimate with somebody than to change their bandages and to change their IV needles. Mm. Every nurse knows this. I learned that by nursing my partner. I would say that probably made me the wisest.
That's amazing. Well, God bless you. What is the cruelest thing that you've ever suffered?
Being reviewed by Stephen Holden. There was a time when he loved me. And then there was a time when he decided he hated me. And I found out, and I will tell you this. Maybe I shouldn't tell you this. The reason that he decided he hated me for a brief time had nothing to do with me. He had a grudge against my press agent. And he took it out on me in print.
Wow.
That's probably telling a tale out of school. But you know what?
We're among friends.
I think that was the cruelest thing. That was worse than being beat up in grade school.
Sometimes I think it's hard to put it out there. So thank you. God bless you for saying it. In what way have you displayed the best taste besides the clothes that you wear?
Probably by choosing KT Sullivan to perform with. And by choosing myriad people that I choose to perform with. When I perform with Nancy McCall, that shows really good taste. Heather McRae, really good taste. Sandra Reeves Phillips, Marta Sanders, really good taste. When I have performed with Richard Skipper, that shows really good taste. I think in my choice of performers that I choose to be seen on stage with.
What an incredible, and I want to say something again about KT. When I first started in this business, she gave me the greatest piece of advice that anyone has ever given me. She said, have at least 5 people who know your show, so you're never at a loss.
Wonderful.
And that was great. What is the worst example of betrayal that you have ever suffered?
You mean being on the road?
Good answer. Okay. What was the hardest decision that you ever had to make?
This is a real sob story. But it's really the truth. Katie and I wrote this show called American Rhapsody, which was a Gershwin review.
Brilliant. And,
thank you. And Louise Westergaard and Steve Downey were two Broadway producers who picked up the show and produced it off Broadway at the Triad Theater. The day of our final preview, two days before our final preview, my mother died. This is how it went. 2 days before the final preview, my mother called me and she said, I'm dying. I'm not going to make it through the weekend. Please come home. Well, when you are the star of an off-Broadway show that people have put a lot of money into, and you don't have an understudy, and it's the final preview, if you don't go on, if you choose to go away for a day, the stagehands don't work, the lighting designer doesn't work, everybody is out of work for a day. It's not just something you can cavalierly say, I have to take this time off. I have to go. My mother's dying. And Louise Westergaard, who was the producer, explained this to me. And I called my mom. I said, Mom, I can't. Please continue to live. Just don't die. And of course she died. And I was not able to go be with her. At the end, as she and my mom and I were really, really close. But yeah, that's certainly the hardest decision I ever had to make. But in a way, I didn't have to make the decision because I didn't have a choice. My choice would have been to then just have no career at all for the rest of my life because I would have been labeled so irresponsible and so such a risk financially. So I that was the hardest.
Wow.
Well, thank you for your honor. I'm getting an echo here, so you may want something bumped.
At the Five Oaks, we used to say, your legs, we're getting an echo.
What is the thing of highest value that you have lost?
People. And many people, each one is of equal high value. My partner, my mother, my father. Susanna McCorkle, who was my best friend, Dawn Hampton, who was my touchstone. Countless people that I have lost are certainly the things of highest value. And second would be my animals.
And my last question, and this is really going to put you on the hot seat.
More than these other questions?
What is the single nastiest thing that you've ever done to someone else?
I can tell you.
Mark, I love you so much.
When I was in summer stock, this was at a place called Caberfay Dinner Theater. After the shows was a cabaret show that we had to do. And of course, I was always the accompanist of the cabaret show. And there was this guy, we were doing You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. I was playing Linus, he was playing Snoopy. And we were on stage and he decided he was going to upstage me when I was singing My Blanket and Me. My only big number, but big dance number. Snoopy, I'm doing My Blanket and Me and I'm doing my choreography. And this guy playing Snoopy is backstage and he's going, he thought that was so funny. Well, that night, at the cabaret, when he went to sing his show-stopping arrangement of Old Man River that I had created for him, I played it a sixth higher, a key that was six steps up. And he wasn't able to hit the notes at all.
Wow.
Don't fuck with the pianist.
No, and on that note, I will say I will never, ever, ever even try to upstage you. I couldn't if I tried. Mark, I love you so much. You have no idea how much I love you. And I love all these people that spent an hour with us today. I know
all of you.
I know I can speak with for Mark when I say this. I don't take it for granted, and neither does he. You could have been anywhere for the last hour, and you chose to be with us. If you are here for the first time, please subscribe to Richard Skipper Celebrates on YouTube. I'm all about celebrating everybody. There's enough negativity in the world.
You really are, and you always have been.
Well, thank you. There's enough negativity out there. I'm not going to add to it. So please subscribe if you haven't done so already. If you like today's show, and how could you not love Mark Nadler, hit the like button, leave a comment, because that increases the ranking of where this will appear. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Now, this is what I want you all to do, every single one of you. And I'm going to put the link up. You're going to go to Flushing Town Hall, and you're going to buy two tickets for Mark's show. You're going to keep one for yourself so that you can enjoy it in real time on Thursday night, and you're going to give one to the seventh friend that pops up on your friend list. This is my gift from me to you. If you know Mark Nadler, you know what the treat you're in for, and if you don't know Mark Nadler, you will now. I can't imagine that anybody would not know you. I also encourage everyone to go to your Facebook friends list and reach out to the seventh name on your list and reach out with a phone call. Not a text message, not an email message, not a private message on Facebook, but a phone call. And let those people know what they mean to you. Because as a dear friend of mine says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. But I'm going to go a step further. If you're going to be out in a boat, make sure that you bring a skipper along.
Yeah.
Now, before we end before we end the show, I'm going to leave the screen, Mark, and I'm giving you the final word because this is about you. Anything that you want to say about anything that we talked about today that you want to expound upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to everyone who's watching right now. And Mark, I thank you for the gifts that you've given to the world and the gifts that you will continue to give. And your body of worth is always worth celebrating. I love you dearly. Thank you.
What I would say to everybody is continue to support Richard Skipper. What he's doing is so honorable and beautiful and so Richard. It's so exactly who he is. I have known Richard now for a long time. He's always been exactly the same. What you see is what you get with Richard Skipper. And please continue to support him and watch his shows. I watched several of them, many of them, and I always find them entertaining. And it was a real honor to be a part of it today. Thank you so much, Richard, for having me. Thank you for celebrating me. I feel celebrated. I really appreciate it.